All right, this is part two of our study on the law of God from chapter 19 in the confession. Let me begin with some review from a couple weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, we saw that the confession distinguishes four kinds of law. The natural law, which was written on man's heart from the beginning. The moral law, which was the natural law republished on two tablets of stone at Mount Sinai. The ceremonial law, which were symbolic and temporary rules that were given to foreshadow Christ. And then today we'll read about the judicial law, which was given to Israel to govern her national life. But before we move on to paragraph four, I want to take a few minutes and address a couple of questions that I received from folks after that last lesson 2 weeks ago. The first question came from Mr. Art, who's not in here right now, and I'm about to answer his question. So that's what comes of being late, folks. You got to be here on time. These two questions are on your handout. The question Mr. Art asked me, good Jewish question here, was if the ceremonial law was meant to be temporary, as we argued, then how are we to understand statements in the Old Testament which refer to some ceremonial laws as perpetual statutes to be observed throughout your generations? You come across those before in the Old Testament? For example, Exodus 40:15 says that Aaron and his sons were to be a perpetual priesthood throughout your generations. So how can we call the Levitical priesthood temporary? I mean, is not perpetual the very opposite of temporary? Or again, Exodus 27:21 says that the lighting of the golden lampstand in the tabernacle was meant to be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations. Or Leviticus 16:34, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, the one day of the year when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies to pour blood on the mercy seat. Leviticus 16 says that that Day of Atonement was meant to be a statute forever. So those are just three examples. There's more. How can we call those Old Testament ceremonies temporary in light of such perpetual, forever language? This is actually a really good test case for how you interpret the Bible, for how you put the whole Bible together. If you simply go straight to those passages and say, well, we got to take them literally, else we're refusing to believe the Bible. Forever means forever. Perpetual means perpetual. If you do that, you're going to end up saying that Levitical priests should still be lighting lampstands and offering sacrifices in an earthly tabernacle. The problem with that way of interpreting the Bible is that it ignores the New Testament. You can't just interpret phrases like perpetual priesthood or forever statute without regard to the New Testament. The New Testament gives us a sort of inspired commentary on how those ceremonies were meant to be fulfilled. So it's not just the confession that labels the tabernacle and the priesthood as temporary. It's the book of Hebrews, especially Hebrews chapter 7 through 10. So, for example, regarding the Day of Atonement, Hebrews 9 teaches us that Christ fulfilled the Day of Atonement when he entered once for all into the holy places in heaven, carrying his own blood, which means that when Leviticus 16 calls the Day of Atonement a statute forever, you have to include the fulfillment in that word, forever. Right? What the Day of Atonement was pointing to will remain forever. But that doesn't mean that the ceremony itself would remain forever. Hebrews 9 teaches us that the outward ceremony was only meant to endure until the time of Reformation, which was when the Messiah came. Same thing with Aaron's priesthood. I'm answering your question right now, Mr. Art. Sorry. Same thing with Aaron's priesthood, the Levitical priesthood. In fact, the book of Hebrews relates Jesus' priesthood to Aaron's priesthood in two different ways. not only does it teach that Christ fulfilled the Levitical priesthood when he went into the holy place in heaven, it also teaches that Christ belongs to a better priesthood than that of Aaron. Here's what we mean. The writer of Hebrews points out that long before the law was ever given, long before there was ever any Levitical priesthood, in Genesis 14, Moses spoke of another priest by the name of Melchizedek, long before the law. And then later, long after the law was given, in Psalm 110 tells us that another priest was going to arise after the order of Melchizedek, and he would be a priest forever. So the writer of Hebrews puts all those pieces together, the fact that this Melchizedek priesthood existed before the law, and it was still predicted to exist after the law, and he reasons like this, quote, Hebrews 7:11, "If perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well." End quote. In other words, for Psalm 110 to come true, the law would have to change. Meaning, the Bible itself, the Old Testament itself, was already indicating that Aaron's priesthood was not going to last forever. Aaron's priesthood was bound up with the Old Covenant. But when the New Covenant came, the Old Covenant would vanish away along with its priesthood. And it would be superseded by a better priest, a priest who would never have to be replaced because he would live forever. And that's Jesus. So the writer of Hebrews is not correcting the Old Testament here. He's not saying, you know, Aaron's priesthood wasn't perpetual after all. Exodus 40 just got it wrong. That's not what it's saying. Nor is he saying, you guys would never have gotten any of this from the Old Testament, but because I'm the inspired apostle here, I can pull things out of the hat that you've never seen before. No, what he's saying is, guys, this was already there in the Old Testament. You just need to know where to look. You just need to know how to see it, how to interpret it. So when we read about perpetual priesthoods and forever statutes in the Old Testament, we need to interpret those in light of the whole Bible. The outward form of the promise would last for as long as the old covenant setup lasted. It's only in Christ that it truly becomes perpetual and forever. So that's the first question I got. Is there anyone have any further questions about that? Mr. Artley, anybody have any further questions? Oh, there you are, about that. Okay. Second question I got from numerous people, actually, was about the Sabbath. So, here basically the question was this. Paragraph 2 of the Confession claims that the Ten Commandments, the moral law, was a republishing of the natural law that had been written on man's heart from the beginning. But if that's true, what about the Sabbath? What about the Fourth Commandment? Is the Confession saying that the Sabbath is part of the natural law written on people's hearts, and that people were already keeping it before Moses? The longer answer to that, we'll have to wait until chapter 22 when we get to the Sabbath. But for now, the short answer is basically yes and no. Yes and no. I leave it to you to give an answer like that. Yes and no. Yes, the writers of the Confession would say that God's people were observing the Sabbath before Moses, because they would argue the Sabbath was a creation ordinance. It's recorded at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapter 2. God created all things in 6 days, and then Genesis 2, 3 says, quote, "So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. So they would ask, why reveal that from the beginning of time if it wasn't going to have any practical relevance for another 2,500 years when God gave the Ten Commandments? As Jesus himself put it, the Sabbath was made not just for Jews, but the Sabbath was made for man. And according to Genesis 2, the Sabbath was pronounced holy from the very beginning. Now, we should grant that there's not much explicit evidence for Sabbath keeping prior to the time of Moses. There's not. But that doesn't prove that no one was doing it. It doesn't prove. The book of Genesis packs 2,000 years of human history into like 8 chapters. So clearly the goal is not to give exhaustive detail about what worship looked like in those early days of human history. We don't have any explicit record of God commanding animal sacrifices either. And yet we find Cain and Abel doing it, or at least Abel doing it. We don't have any explicit record of God distinguishing between clean and unclean animals. And yet when he tells Noah, take 7 of the unclean, or 7 of the clean, to the unclean, Noah seems to know what he's talking about. And in a similar way, when God mentions the Sabbath to them in Exodus 16, he's talking about the manna. You know, 6 days you'll get manna every morning, but not on the Sabbath day. When he mentions the Sabbath to them in Exodus 16, they seem to know what he's talking about. They're not like, Sabbath? What are you talking about? I've never even heard that there was such a Sabbath. And that's Exodus 16, before the Ten Commandments were given. So, on the one hand, yes, the writers of the Confession would argue that people were observing the Sabbath, or at least they ought to have been, before the time of Moses. On the other hand, no, that's not because somehow the 1 day in 7 rule was written on people's hearts so that they just somehow knew that that's what they should do. Rather, the Confession teaches, if you go over to chapter 22 on the Sabbath, the Confession teaches that the fourth command, the Sabbath command, is not just natural law. Rather, it's a mixture of natural law and what they call positive law. Positive law. Now, positive law is not the opposite of negative law. Positive law refers to laws that they're only right because the lawgiver says so. Like it's something that's right because the law says so, or it's wrong because the law says so, not because it's somehow inherently right or wrong. So, for example, if you're driving down the road in your car, the natural law says, be careful not to kill anyone. Be careful not to hit anyone. You wouldn't want them to hit you, so don't hit them. Love your neighbor when you're driving. Love does no harm to his neighbor. That was true before cars were invented. It's true today when you're driving your car. So you're driving down the road in your car. The natural law says, be careful not to hit other drivers. Positive law says, drive on the right-hand side of the road. Drive on the right-hand side. Why? Because nature itself teaches that it's wrong to drive on the left side of the road? Well, no. But because the law of the land says to drive on the right-hand side of the road. There's nothing inherently right or wrong about it. In fact, could the law not just as easily have said drive on the left side of the road? Yes or no? Yeah. And in England, it does say that. Right? Australia, it says that. It's like on the surface, those two positive laws are contradictory. One says drive on the right, one says drive on the left. But the point beneath them is the same. And that's, we're trying to give order to your driving so that everybody doesn't have to decide from moment to moment, which side am I going to drive on today, I wonder? Right? That wouldn't go well. It's bad enough as it is. So, natural law is fixed, but positive law is flexible. It can change from time to time and from place to place. And in a similar way, when it comes to the worship of God, the natural law teaches that there is a God who is powerful, good, a God whom we are obligated to love and honor and worship and obey. So the natural law would even lead us to see the need to set aside time to focus and worship this God. But the natural law does not teach us that we ought to set aside one day out of seven to worship that God. That's the positive law, drive on the right-hand side of the road, part of the law. Right? That's not written on the heart of every human being. You can never look at nature and conclude, I ought to worship God one day out of every 7 days. The light of nature would never teach you to do that. In fact, creation would not even teach you that there is such a thing as a seven-day week. Would it? As far as I know, there are patterns in creation, patterns in nature that would tell you about the month, how long a month is, how long a year is, how long a day is. But as far as I know, there's nothing in nature that gives us a seven-day week. The seven-day week is rooted in the fact that God created all things in 6 days, and he rested on the seventh. And we would never have known that unless he told us. So, assuming that people were observing the Sabbath before Moses, that would either have been because of oral tradition passed down through the centuries from Adam, or it would have been through some other form of special revelation. Maybe God just told them verbally to do it. But there was no scripture before Moses, so they wouldn't have known that apart from God telling them. So just to be clear then, the confession is not claiming that deep down everyone just knows they ought to take Sundays off and come worship God. That's not what the confession is saying. Rather, the confession teaches that the fourth command is a mixture of natural law and positive law. The natural law part is fixed. The positive law part is flexible. In fact, the confession would say, that's why in the New Testament, the day could change from the seventh day, which was commemorating the old creation, to the first day, commemorating the new creation when Christ rose from the dead as the first fruits of his creatures, because that part's flexible. We'll come back to all that whenever we get to chapter 22 about the Sabbath. But I wanted to address those now because somebody asked me. So, paragraph 4, the judicial law. These are on your handout. And I believe I've left you some blanks. Yes, I have. So the judicial law, given to Israel to govern their national life. The judicial law, given to Israel to govern their national life. Paragraph 4, which is on your handout, reads like this. To them, that is to Israel, he also gave various judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, their general equity only being of moral use. So judicial laws or civil laws were laws that governed Israel's political life, her national life, under the old covenant. In some cases, they were positive laws, kind of like drive on the right-hand side of the road. And in other cases, they were just customs meant to distinguish Israel from other nations. So laws like build a parapet around your roof so that people don't fall off of it, Deuteronomy 22:8. Or pay your workers at the end of each workday, lest they go hungry, Deuteronomy 24:14. Or don't muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, Deuteronomy 25:4. Or let your land lie fallow every seventh year and don't sow it, Leviticus 25:4. Or if your brother dies without a son, you're responsible for raising up seed to your dead brother by marrying his widow, Deuteronomy 25. So those are civil laws, judicial laws. And there's a sense in which all civil laws, all judicial laws are positive laws, regardless of which nation they belong to. Now, it's true that Israel's judicial laws were unique among all civil laws because they came directly from God himself. So they were unique in that. But they still came from God to Israel for a specific time and place. And that's why the confession says that they expired together with the state of that people, Old Testament Israel, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution. In other words, the judicial laws of ancient Israel are no more binding on Christians today than the laws of Canada are binding on Americans. It's just two different things. Nor are the judicial laws of the Old Testament binding on any nation today. The New Covenant Church is not a civil nation like Old Testament Israel was. And modern nations are not in special covenant with God the way Old Testament Israel was. Calvin said it this way in his Institutes. I think this is on your, yeah, it is. It's on your handout. Regarding the reason that modern nations or Christians are not under the judicial laws, Calvin said, "We do not abrogate that which was never given to us. For the Lord gave not that law by the hand of Moses to be promulgated among all nations and to be universally binding, but after having taken the Jewish nation into his special charge, he was pleased to become, in a peculiar manner, their legislator. And as became a wise legislator, in all the laws that he gave them, he had a special regard to their peculiar circumstances." So those laws served their purpose, and now they've expired. There's a book by a guy named David Dixon called Truth's Victory Over Error, a commentary on the Westminster Confession of Faith, published in 1684, 5 years before this confession was published. And this is it right here. You can borrow it if you'd like. It's a handy guide for interpreting the confession because it was written during the same time period that the confessions were written in, and because Dixon knew a lot of the authors of the Westminster Confession. And so basically the whole book follows the chapter order of the confession, and it gets at the meaning by asking questions and giving answers, kind of like a catechism almost. And so here's the section, I've given it on your handout, front and back. You have a longer handout than normal today because of this quote. I've given you Dixon's questions and answers about this paragraph, the paragraph on the judicial law. So Dixon gives the questions and answers like this. First, he says, "Did the Lord by Moses give to the Jews as a body politic sundry judicial laws, which expire together with that state?" Answer, yes. Question again, "Do they oblige any other now, further than the general equity thereof may require?" Answer, no. Again, this is just basic reading right off the confession, questions and answers. "Well then, do not some err, though otherwise orthodox, who maintain that the whole judicial law of the Jews is yet alive and binding on all of us who are Gentile, who are Christian Gentiles?" Like, isn't it wrong for some people to claim that all the judicial laws are still in force? He says, yes, they are wrong. They do err. Well, by what reasons are they confuted? Why are they wrong? He gives four answers. I'm only going to deal with three of them. By what reasons are they confuted? Well, number one, he says, because the judicial law was delivered by Moses to the Israelites to be observed as a body politic. So it was given to that nation. Number two, because this law, in many things which are of a particular right, was accommodated to the commonwealth of the Jews and not for other nations also. And here in those verses, he cites laws regulating slavery, laws about divorce, and laws about Levirate marriage, that practice of raising up seed for your dead brother. And Dixon is saying those laws are meant to govern Israel in their specific circumstances, their time and place. It's not that those laws were bad or unjust. I mean, they were given by God, after all. It's simply that these are examples of God giving positive laws that are flexible in their outward form. In those historical circumstances, here was one way you could apply the natural law to the civil laws of a nation. That doesn't mean that all other nations have to do it exactly the same way. So, for example, it would be foolish for our civil law to require us to build a parapet around our roof. It would be foolish because we don't have flat roofs in our culture. People don't spend, other than roofers, people don't spend time up on their roof. And if you're a roofer, you have workman's comp if you fall off. That would be foolish to try to just cookie cutter reproduce that law in our civil law. It would be overkill, for the most part, to require employers to pay their workers at the end of every workday in our society. Because thankfully, for the most part, most people are just not that poor. They're not going to starve to death or go cold and hungry if they don't get paid till the end of the week. And it would also be counterproductive in our culture to reinstitute the law requiring widows to marry their brother-in-law so that he can raise up seed for his dead brother. That would be counterproductive. For one thing, it would require us to reinstitute polygamy in a culture where happily we've been rid of it for over 400 years for now. And moreover, when you read Deuteronomy 25 about the Levirate marriage, it seems very clear that the widows in that day would have welcomed this practice. In fact, the widow is actually allowed to take off the guy's sandal and spit in his face if he refused to do his duty. The exact opposite would be the case in our culture. Your sister-in-law would spit in your face if you offered to marry her. And so would your own wife. There are laws that make sense in a particular time and place that simply do not make sense in another particular time and place. That you can solve the problem those laws were trying to solve another way without unleashing havoc the way you would if we tried to do it here. So that's what Dixon is talking about here when he says that this law, under number two, this law and many things which are of a particular right, was accommodated to the commonwealth of the Jews and not to other nations also. Then he gives a third reason why other nations are not bound to follow the judicial laws of Israel. He says, because in other things which are not of a particular right, it is neither from the law of nature, obliging by reason, neither is it pressed upon believers under the gospel to be observed. In other words, he's saying, in some cases, the judicial laws of Israel were not from the law of nature. They didn't reflect the natural law. They were not rooted in the permanent natural law. And where it wasn't, other nations are not obligated to follow it. Where they were rooted in permanent natural law, then that's where our lawmakers have to have the wisdom to know how to apply those same eternal principles in our time and place, in our culture, so that you can actually do it in a way that's helpful and not counterproductive. That's when the confession here speaks of the general equity. It says these laws have expired. They don't bind anyone except for the general equity. The general equity, that remains of moral use. That general equity is the part of the judicial law that carries on. It's the part where the judicial law overlaps with the natural law. And so insofar as Israel's judicial laws were a reflection of permanent moral principles, then those permanent moral principles are still binding, though not necessarily the specific applications in law. Those are flexible. Again, Calvin says it this way, which is on your handout at the end, or after Dixon's thing. Calvin says, it is certain that the law of God, which we call the moral law, is no other than a declaration of natural law and of that conscience which has been engraven by God on the minds of men. The whole rule of this equity is prescribed in it. This equity, therefore, must alone be the scope and rule and end of all laws. So the permanent moral principles embedded in the judicial law, those are fine, but you need to find another way to turn them into civil law. In other words, God doesn't expect modern lawmakers to just take the judicial laws of the Old Testament and just put them like a cookie cutter in our land today. But there are still enduring principles that can be of use. And just because the United States is not in some special covenant relationship with God the way Israel was, that doesn't mean that we can just make whatever laws we want. And God's going to be up there being like, well, that's all right, I guess. It's not like they're Old Testament Israel or anything. No, the principle still holds that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. That still holds. And when you read the Old Testament, Read the prophets. You find that even back then, God held other nations accountable for their violations of the natural law. Their idolatry, their immorality, their oppression of the vulnerable. He held them accountable, even if they weren't in covenant with him. And he will hold the United States accountable as well for its violations of the natural law. And some of them are very glaring today. But the point here is simply that the judicial laws of Israel are not directly binding on any other nation aside from the moral principles that are embedded in them. 10:02. Questions or comments on judicial law before we move on? Mr. Art over here.
So there are well-meaning believers who would say, 1948, we have a state of Israel. They've come back. They exist once again. Therefore, those laws should apply in the state of Israel. Any thoughts or comments?
Well, obviously, the confession was written 300 years before the modern state of Israel was formed, so they didn't have that in their minds at all when they wrote this. But they would, based on what they still say, they would still say, the nation of Israel, the Old Testament, Old Covenanted nation of Israel expired. Temple was destroyed. Even Orthodox Jews don't do all the Old Testament stuff anymore because they don't have a temple, right? So they find other ways to do it. So I would say Israel is obligated, like any other nation, to form just laws according to the natural law. If they wanted to follow some of those things as just national customs, I don't know that there's any problem with that necessarily, but if you're a Christian Jew, at any rate, it would seem problematic if you tried to sacrifice animals, right, because the Old Testament said so. Like, if you're a Christian Jew, you've got to believe the New Testament, right? So those things would be a problem, but we know even Baruch Ma'oz would still celebrate certain Jewish holidays because he's a citizen of Israel, so I don't want to deny them their national customs any more than I'd want them to deny me mine. But they just need to line up with basic biblical orthodoxy. So that, any follow-up on that? Who else? What else? Brother Nate, right back here.
So I was looking for the exact passage, but what do you say to there are different groups today that are following Old Testament law. And they would, of course, say that we would not follow the sacrificial law because Christ has done away with that. But they point to the passage in Matthew where Jesus says, whoever breaks the least of these commandments, and I think the context was referring to not one jot or tittle shall pass away till all the law be fulfilled. Whoever breaks the least of these commandments shall be condemned. And I can't remember the wording. So What do you say when they point that back to all the law? And that's one question. And I have a second.
I just say, do you think the Jesus' apostles who wrote Romans and Galatians and 1 Corinthians, do you think they were teaching a different message than Jesus was?
Right.
Because that's not how they interpret it. That's not how they apply it. They don't say, in Christ, circumcision actually does matter. They say, in Christ, circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. What matters is you keep the commandments of God, 1 Corinthians 7. So clearly they're making a distinction between keeping God's commandments and keeping certain Old Testament commandments, like circumcision. So just say you can't split Jesus apart from his apostles and say that they misinterpreted him. Not if you're going to be an Orthodox believer. Go ahead.
And then I think you dealt with this well, but I was just maybe asking for a little more clarification. When you talk about, obviously, the United States is not, when you were talking about how people say, well, we're not covenant Israel, so
right.
There's so many things in the Old Testament. We're talking about promises, you know, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray, and I will heal their land. People will often say, well, that was talking about covenant Israel.
Right.
And then even more so when we talk about how a nation, a Christian nation, a nation that I would say, if there's a predominant Christian influence, like you see this in African nations now, where these African nations are passing laws to restrain sin. Mm-hmm. But yet they're not covenant Israel. Is that what it's supposed to look like, you know, when a nation, you know, because that gets you into the whole theonomy debate. What does it look like when a nation that is not covenant Israel, clearly, is trying to follow God's laws and dive down deeper than the Ten Commandments dive?
Right. I knew you'd ask something like this, Nate. At one level, you know, you hear the phrase, like, you can't legislate morality. You can't legislate morality. Like, I don't know what else you can legislate. Like, nobody believes that. Nobody really believes that you can't legislate morality. That's what it, that if government is not to restrain sin and wickedness, what exactly is it for? Right? So, you know, don't steal is one of the Ten Commandments. Does that make us a theocracy because we have laws against stealing? If so, the Roman Empire was a theocracy. Like, basically every nation has certain laws against things like stealing and murder because these things are part of the natural law written on the heart of man. Right? They mess it up. They pervert parts of it. But basically that's why you'll see the same kinds of laws in pretty much every nation. Now, and so, you know, the idea that we've reached a point now where it's like, if you think marriage is between a man and a woman, you're like a theocrat. Right? You're a Christian nationalist. And I'm like, well, I guess Barack Obama was a theocrat his entire first term then, because he believed that his whole first term. It's just, it's unfair to try to make it, to try to act like, or you hear things like, if you start talking about transgenderism or laws against drag queen story hours and things, people are like, well, you can't expect non-Christians to live like Christians. I'm like, well, until about 5 minutes ago, it seemed like everybody was against drag queen story hours, Christian or non-Christian. What exactly happened? So I just think there's some foolishness. The law is not trying to make non-Christians act like Christians, but it is trying to keep them from destroying each other. Martin Luther King said one time, the law can't make a white guy love me, but it can keep him from lynching me, and that's a pretty good thing too. Right? So where it comes down, I think, where it gets stickier is when you start talking about the first table of the law. Laws about worshiping God, laws about idolatry. So our confession is basically exactly the same as the Westminster Confession in this paragraph. But the Presbyterians back then, they would have said it's the government's job to enforce the first table as well. So the government has the responsibility to promote the true religion, to punish and suppress heresy, and so on. That's why you had, you know, that's why you had people burned at the stake or thrown in jail because of heresy. And the Baptists came along and they said, no, we don't think that's a good idea. Like, we just don't think that's a good idea, partly because they were the ones being thrown in jail by other Christians in that context because they weren't obeying the law. That's why John Bunyan went to jail. He was thrown in jail by the Church of England, right? Because they believed that the government should enforce both tables of the law. That's part of this whole discussion and debate as well. And whatever you think about the government promoting the true religion, it doesn't seem feasible right now in our culture. Like, we got bigger fish to fry at the moment than trying to put Jesus into the Constitution. I'd like to keep minors from having transgender surgeries before we get to that point. So,
just go back to, yeah, I agree with that. But we'd have to go back to the foundation being God's law, right? Because it's right. Like, well, you have people today that are frustrated, atheists that are saying, how do we get to this point? I mean, they are people right. Like Bill Murray, I'm thinking of the comedian that is against transgenderism and woke policies, but doesn't know why he is.
Dave Chappelle.
No. Three more.
I thought he was too. Watch Dave Chappelle.
Who'd you say?
Yes,
Maher. So
Bill Maher. Okay, yeah.
So they don't know why they are. You know, like, they don't know how we got here. Well, we know how we got here. We've abandoned God's law. We've abandoned absolute. So on the other hand, then you have people on the other side, the flip side of the coin, who are like, we can't have traffic laws because we can't find it in the Old Testament.
Right.
So anyway, I'll shut up.
I think part of it comes back to the distinction here between general equity, natural law, and specific judicial laws that Israel had or that we pass. There are things that are right and wrong for everybody everywhere, and those things ought to be forbidden and restrained. But not every sin ought to be made a crime, right? So it just the wisdom comes in knowing like which sins need to be made crimes, and that takes wisdom. So, you know, should it be a crime to be an atheist or worship God or worship a false god? I would say it's a sin. I don't think it's wise to make it a crime, and that's what Baptists historically have always said. So we may be wrong, but that's been the standard. Jared, go ahead. It's coming. Sure, go ahead. No, go for it.
Because we have several families who are friends who hold to those kind of ideas with the law, and they always bring up those dietary laws and the sacrificial laws and stuff, and they do use Matthew quite a bit. And I always like to point out to them, I found it helpful, that there's a sense where the Bible has a historical timeline as well. So in Matthew, when Jesus is speaking, that was before the cross and the resurrection. Hebrews is 60 years later, where it's saying, looking back to the cross, saying, this has been fulfilled. And I think because they misunderstand the way covenants work, that this covenant was fulfilled and it's no longer binding because now there's a new covenant through the new mediator in the sacrificial system of Christ. And I think that's where the line gets blurred when they use Matthew as opposed to Hebrews.
Thank you, brother. Anybody else? Rob over here, Rob Young.
So from a personal application standpoint of the judicial laws, I think one helpful thing we can get out of them is God's character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that's what you're getting at, where you talk about the principle that right. still applies. Because not only does the principle still apply, but the character of God that led to that principle, that led to that specific law, is still something to worship.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you mentioned Exodus 21 on here. So, if you start reading through Exodus 21, you know, you see God's value on life, his value for the vulnerable, like slaves, widows. You see his value for justice in terms of personal property damage, and you just see his goodness mm-hmm. all over these laws. And so I think, you know, there's kind of two ways to think about this. There's, you know, a legislative sense, like what should we do with our legal system based on these laws? But then also from a personal sense, we can think about how can this lead us to worship, and how can this lead us to treat others based on what we see here?
That's good. Yeah, Paul uses the don't muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. Paul uses that, and he boils down the principle in his mind, and he applies it in other ways that have nothing to do with oxen, right? Because he's thinking the basic principle is if someone is working for you, if they're helping you, if they're providing you with a service, then you ought to take care of them in some way. You know, like don't make them work and thresh the grain and be like, but no grain for you. Like that's not right. So just think about what that means and then be creative and apply that. And I think that's, Nate, I think where some of the sort of nitpickiness about you can't even have traffic laws because it's not mentioned in the Bible. I think it's just a very wooden, minimalistic. It's like you need to think about, like it's the principle here. You know, if people are going to drive 70 miles an hour, you know, down a street, you need something to help give order to that, or we're all going to kill each other, right? So it's not, you don't need specific black and white laws. You just need good sense. Like, you need wisdom. So, well, this worked out perfectly. I had a manuscript that was way too long today. Now I can just save most of it for next time. So we're going to close down and have our lemonade and coffee, and then we'll come back to worship the Lord when the lights blink. So let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your law. God, thank you for all of it. Lord, help us to tremble at your word. Help us to love your law. And even in places where we know we don't literally obey it, Lord, help us to respect it and pray and meditate to see what it's teaching about you and how we can apply it in loving you and loving our neighbor. We ask this in the name of Jesus Christ, the only lawgiver. Amen.